This story was submitted by a listener, and in our newsletter, we asked for people to submit stories that they want to hear featured. So you guys can do that too by emailing us at napleswritersworkshop@gmail.com. Welcome to Why Is This Good, a podcast by the Naples Writers Workshop. I'm Christine and I'm here with John. Hey, John.
Hello.
All right, it was my turn to pick a story. And rather than choose a story myself, we've been asking listeners to email us with stories that they really like that they want to see featured on the podcast. So this is one that was submitted by a listener, and it is called Separating by John Updike.
We've done one other Updike in the past, A and P, the classic.
Oh, yeah. That's a great one.
That is a good one. Yeah. This is very different.
Yeah, it is. Richard asked her, "Do you still want to live in England forever?" Forever, the concept now a reality upon him, pressed and scratched at the back of his throat. "No," Judith confessed, turning her oval face to him, its eyes still childishly far apart, but the lips set as over something succulent and satisfactory. "I was anxious to come home. I'm an American." She was a woman. They had raised her. He and Joan had endured together to raise her, alone of the four. The others had still some raising left in them, yet it was the thought of telling Judith, the image of her, their first baby, walking between them arm in arm to the bridge that broke him. The partition between his face and tears broke. Richard sat down to the celebratory meal with the back of his throat aching. The champagne, the lobster seemed phases of sunshine. He saw them and tasted them through tears. He blinked, swallowed, croakily joked about hay fever. The tears would not stop leaking through. They came not through a hole that could be plugged, but through a permeable spot in a membrane, steadily, purely, endlessly, fruitfully. They became his tears, a shield for himself against these others, their faces, the fact of their assembly, a last time as innocence at a table where he sat the last time as head. Tears dropped from his nose as he broke his lobster's back, salt flavored his champagne as he sipped it. The raw clench at the back of his throat was delicious. He could not help himself. His children tried to ignore his tears. Judith, on his right, lit a cigarette, gazed upward in the direction of her too energetic, too sophisticated exhalation. On her other side, John earnestly bent his face to the extraction of the last morsels, legs, tail, segments from the scarlet corpse. Joan, at the opposite end of the table, glanced at him surprised, her reproach displaced by a quick grimace, a forgiveness or a salute to a superior gift of strategy. Between them, Margaret, no longer called Bean, 13 and large for her age, gazed from the other side of his pane of tears as if into a shop window at something she coveted, at her father, a crystalline heap of splinters and memories. It was not she, however, but John, who in the kitchen, as they cleared the plates and carapaces away, asked Joan the question, "Why is Daddy crying?" Richard heard the question but not the murmured answer. Then he heard Bean cry, "Oh, no, oh," the faintly dramatized exclamation of one who had long expected it. John returned to the table carrying a bowl of salad. He nodded tersely at his father, and his lips shaped the conspiratorial words she told. "Told what?" Richard asked aloud, insanely. The boy sat down as if to rebuke his father's distraction with the examples of his own good manners. He said quietly, "The separation." Joan and Margaret returned. The child and Richard's twisted vision seemed diminished in size and seemed relieved. Relieved to have had the boogeyman at last proved real. He called out to her. The distances at the table had grown immense. "You knew, you always knew," but the clenching at the back of his throat prevented him from making sense of it. From afar, he heard Joan talking, lovely, sensibly, reciting what they had prepared. It was a separation for the summer, an experiment. She and Daddy both agreed it would be good for them. They needed space and time to think. They liked each other, but did not make each other happy enough somehow. Judith, imitating her mother's factual tone, but in her youth, off-key, too cool, said, "I think it's silly. You should either live together or get divorced." Richard's crying, like a wave that had crested and crashed, had become tumultuous, but it was overtopped by another tumult. For John, who had been so reserved, now grew larger and larger at the table, perhaps his younger sister's being credited with knowing set him off. "Why didn't you tell us?" he asked, in a large round voice quite unlike his own. "You should have told us you weren't getting along." Richard was startled into attempting to force words through his tears. "We do get along, that's the trouble, so it doesn't show, even to us, that we do not love each other," was the rest of the sentence he couldn't finish. Joan finished for him in her style, "and we've always especially loved our children." Yeah, so like I said, this one was suggested by a listener, and I really enjoyed it. I'd never read this one before. I was telling you before we started recording that the writing style, I mean, there's all these clauses. You kind of get lost in these sentences, and then when you kind of get in the flow of the style, it makes a lot more sense. But So much is packed into all of this narration.
There's a certain thing that he does, which I find interesting for a reason I'll get to, but it's this. So just a random example. He says his younger daughter, having been at a slumber party the night before, slept on the porch hammock through all the noise, heavy and pink, trusting and forsaken. This two adjectives, that like comma, two adjectives, like you could say like there was a wall, gray and tall, right? Something like that. I have long found that particular thing to be like a tick that I do when I write. And I go back and forth between wanting to like completely stop doing it because it's like, why do I do, why am I like pouring adjectives out?
Yeah.
Thinking like, but sometimes they just work. Sometimes that's like good, like little moment. And I must have like read some voice, some author has done this in the past.
Right.
I haven't read a lot of Updike, so I can't say that it's him. But this story, I was like, hey, this is kind of like what would have been a model for that sort of construction that I've taken on over the years.
But you do like it?
I go back and forth for myself. Like sometimes I think it's terrible. And sometimes I think I just find just the right words where it does work. But he, the way it pulled off in here, I like it. I really like the way he did it in this story. So that I just wanted to throw that out as like a, we often like coming from Hemingway, that advice of like, get rid of your adjectives. It's like sometimes adjectives just are great. They can really, really paint a picture.
Right. And I think too, the adjectives themselves can be strong. They can be the exact right adjective, but they're also completely pertinent to whatever it is you're trying to describe. Like he didn't describe this little girl as like young and sleepy.
Yeah, exactly. They're characterizing.
Yeah. He's pointing out that in this moment, she has no clue what's about to happen. So I think as long as they're done correctly, even Hemingway wouldn't have an issue with it.
Oh, we talked about in Hemingway, the story we did of Hemingway's The Big Tree. Big is an adjective.
Yeah. Good job, Ernie. Yeah. So he definitely has this style and it's kind of thick to kind of wade through. But like I said, like once you're kind of going, it's like singing and humming along. And I think it especially, I want to reread like A&P now, but I think it especially works for a story like this where it's definitely told through the dad's perspective, through Richard's perspective, but there's this cast of characters all on the page all at once and they're talking, but it's more about like what's left unsaid that's important. And so that's where this style of narration where it's like Judith can't just light a cigarette, right? Because there's so much more to it in this moment. For these characters, this is like this heightened experience. She's not just lighting a cigarette. She's lighting it. And then the way she's looking up to the sky, it's like, it means something, right? Everything is weighted. Yeah. In this, what I read, it said, Judith on his right lit a cigarette, gazed upward in the direction of her too energetic, too sophisticated exhalation. I think in other situations, this might be the kind of writing that was distracting. Or to your point about adjectives, they might not be pertinent details that we need to know about. But I think at least in this character's interpretation of the moment, it's so important. It has so much gravity. He really does think that this conversation is what is going to turn the tide on his family forever, right?
Yes. There are moments in this writing where I was like, this feels fussy. Like it's very like niggling, but it is that way for a purpose. Like there's an effect to that.
Right.
I think it's like you said, it's because it's in those details, everything just comes alive because it's looking in those places. The prose is actually like diving into all those little moments. That's what brings it to life. Otherwise, I mean, if you tried to like make this more terse, you wouldn't get it. You wouldn't get any of those levels.
No, it'd be a different story completely. And maybe if Richard wasn't Richard, you could get away with the terse description. But I think the other half of this story and like whether or not you like it is whether or not you like Richard. And I think he's annoying. I think he's like making this all about himself, right? And he really does think that
it is a little bit about him, right?
It is a little bit about him, but he also is not honest with any of the characters. And it's not until the very end when he's driving that he mentions in passing that he's driving past the home of the woman he hopes to marry. And it doesn't even delve into the
fact
that
like some little mention, like she was kind of foreshadowed earlier, but that's like the moment where you give her that foreshadow kind of like crystallizes. So
he's over here like, woe is me, I'm a horrible person. And it's like, yes, but you don't even know why. So you don't get the benefit of like feeling that way about yourself. Yeah. I don't have any pity for you because like you won't even articulate why it is you are the bad guy. You just feel bad for, oh, my kids. And then there's also something like so self-important to assume that your family was happy to begin with, to assume that you had a perfect life, to assume that this really will be the defining moment of your children's existence. Like it's so self-important. And yet he's not looking at himself very clearly or level, you know, like the wife is just kind of like, like, let's get this over with. Like, I think we should tell them all. I think we should tell them all at once, or however they decide. It all gets screwed up. They want to tell maybe the oldest daughter first. It all gets screwed up is the point. But then he puts so much stake in how it's being told, as if it can be told in a way that's going to benefit him, or like to soften the blow. It's like, I don't know. I thought the writing style itself lends itself to this idea that Richard is just beside himself.
Yeah. There's something almost febrile about it.
What is that word?
Febrile. It's like feverish. Like,
Yeah. Having or showing the symptoms of a fever. 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 Febrile.
But, you know, like, you know how fever dreams are? They're very, intense.
Yeah.
But also vivid. They're intense and vivid. And I think that's what I'm reacting to here. It's just like, because it's so, and fussy might not be the right word, but because it's so fussy about all the details, it makes them very vivid. And then they're also, like you said, he's avoiding a lot of things. So it's like, it's kind of like moving around things. And it's it's because it's avoiding things. It's like touching things that aren't the central thing, which is a really interesting thing. I don't know. The prose is kind of amazing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This is the kind of writing you probably can't hope to mimic.
What's fascinating about this is it is so different from A&P. This is the kind of, when I talk about like voice, people talk about author's voice, which is such a vacuous, nobody can define it, because anytime you try to define what voice is, you talk about specific things that aren't fixed, right? Like your style, like voice isn't style, because style can change. And so when people talk about voice, I always push back, like, I don't think any author should try to have a voice, because I think a story should have a voice, not an author, if that makes sense. And so it's really nice to see that Updike can pull off this style in this story and such a different style in A&P. And each story kind of like brings to life a different voice that he is capable of capturing, if you will. So I think it would be an interesting exercise to kind of put these two stories next to each other and figure out what are the mechanical things that make them so different.
Right.
Having been produced by the same author.
Right. Yeah. So it is cool to see that. I mean, if he's doing this like intentionally as a way to capture Richard, it's the exact right tone for this character, right? And like what he's going through, and like that this voice is like very much in line with his own. I don't want to read this whole first paragraph, but the first paragraph sets up the idea that like it's about to be summer. It's a beautiful day. He's working at the house like he should be. But then they're talking about how the daughter's coming in, and the plan is to tell her about this in a couple days after she's recovered from the jet lag, you know, and like sit everyone down and kind of say it. But I just like this last line, because it says, so he had trudged away in love and dread, repairing screens, getting the mower sharpened, rolling and patching their new tennis court. This is like, I think the way John Updike is capturing what Richard is going through in this moment, I think is just, it's so well done. I totally understand what it's like when the weather outside doesn't mimic your mood, when all the realities of the world and the time and place and the realities of even like the people that you're closest to don't match your own reality, right? Like his daughter's coming in from England. She's young and excited about life, and Richard is over here like he feels like his is ending in a way, right? So like nothing is matching. And so when he's going around like doing the yard work, I just thought that was like one of the strongest visuals. I feel like what I'll remember of this story is not him crying at dinner, but how he's kind of going about tending to a property that's in a day or two not going to be his anymore, and by all accounts he shouldn't have to care about, but he still does somehow, and the grass is going to keep growing even when he leaves, you know? So someone's going to have to do it, and it's this weird like sign and symbol to do it. But then they mentioned like this tennis court, and I'm like, these people are rolling in cash. Their daughter's coming from Europe. They have like lobster for dinner, you know? Like, who are these people?
They're in New York with this giant parcel of property.
I think that rich people can get divorced too, and it can be sad, sure. But I think what makes Richard even more insufferable is the idea that he's got this wealth and he still acts like things can't ever be the same, like that this is ruined somehow. And I'm like, Richard, like, you have money, you'll be fine. You know, you'll get to see your kids, you'll get to pay for them to do great things. You'll buy their love on a daily basis. And like whether or not that was ever like at risk is like sort of less important, because they've also grown up that way. They've grown up like kind of expecting this. It's just funny because all of the realities that we think about when we think about divorce are not alive and well here. They're not talking about losing the house and the tennis court. You know what I mean? The kids are just going to like maybe miss their dad, but like how much could they really miss him? It's interesting. Like it makes the whole plot itself makes him that much less relatable. I think, like, if anything, the section where I stopped reading, the next paragraph, it kind of talks about there's another line by Richard, and he says to his kids, "You're not little things we had, you're the whole point." So maybe he really just does think that, like, having them all assembled is like the high of his life, and it's not going to happen anymore. But I don't know. I just don't have much pity for him.
Well, I mean, that's what this is, right? It's like
Yeah.
he and his wife have made a decision that's gonna like impact all the kids, and they've put it off because they also made the decision to reveal it in a specific way. It's an interesting dynamic where a couple is planning to separate, you know, that's the title, and yet maintains their coupleness, their couplehood.
Right.
It's like we're going to hold on to this couplehood for this reason, and that's what all his like fussing around the house and like fixing things and like, by the way, the tennis court thing where he's like, I wanted to like make this great tennis court and take care of it. And then the description of how it's like falling apart is like a great undermining there. But when he describes the plan that his wife is like, this is what the plan is, this is how we're going to tell them. I wrote plan next to it because anytime a story introduces the plan, you know, the plan's not going to go off the way that anybody wants it to. But so the separation is like the story, right? It is like, how are we going to tell the kids this? And then nothing goes to plan, which is it can't, right? That's part of like ratcheting up, like we talked about in previous episodes. Like things have to fall apart. Like the other one, the kid like eating paper and like eating a cigarette and like all
And they're
this
like,
stuff. Like,
"Oh, we kind of realized he was drunk off the champagne." I'm like, "You guys are a mess. Don't act like you're great parents either." You know what I mean? Like,
oh yeah, like nobody's handling this well.
I thought it was cool. I've never read a story like this where the characters have already come to the conclusion themselves and they're just going to tell the kids. I don't think I've ever, I've ne this premise has not, I mean, maybe like in certain movies, like I'm thinking only of Mrs. Doubtfire because we just saw the play. Like there's a moment where they tell the kids, like, "We're getting divorced," and the kids all have, I mean, I think there's three kids, they all have three different reactions, you know? Like there's something like really powerful about like a scene like that where they're kids, but they
Yeah.
are in that moment. Especially, you see how strikingly different they are. How, like, you see the flashes of them as adults, how they each decide to handle this, right? Like, we know the little boy that's like eating paper is probably gonna, you know, end up in prison. We know that. But no, just like they each handle it wildly differently, and it's because they are like coming of age, and you could argue in this moment, coming of age, right? Because for the first time, they have to deal with something that feels really unfair but affects their entire daily lives and everything going forward, right?
Yeah.
And it, in a lot of ways, has nothing to do with them. And that's what coming of age is, right? Just like the most unfair thing in the world happening to you. And it doesn't really matter that it's unfair. You just have to deal with it. So that feels like the other kind of crux of the story. I cared, my point being like a little less about Richard because we know why, Richard. What do you mean? Like, you don't want to do this anymore. You found something cooler. And the wife is over it too. But telling the kids, then that's the real consequence. Not that your family's
Yeah.
broken up, but what it's going to do to each of them.
Yeah, I think you put it well that he is approaching it as if it's about him, but it's not.
Yeah, not, I mean, right now it feels like it's about him, but I think he's worried about the wrong thing.
What we're able to see through this, with all the details the prose gives us, is how it affects everybody else.
Sort of like in real time. Yeah, I thought it was an interesting premise for a story too. I'm trying to think of a takeaway. I don't think that you can write like this just by even practicing, because aside from what you like very clearly articulated with like the comma, two adjectives, there's not like this exact precise formula that results in this kind of writing. But like the closest I can think is that maybe if you were to write a story where there is a group of characters all in the scene together, and maybe they're all reacting to something, and they're reacting to it not just verbally, like how then would you convey what they're thinking? And you'd have to do it this way, which is through Richard's interpretation of each of their actions. And this is like, you know, the type of writing, like third person, whatever. I don't know. I'm bad at that. Where we're seeing it through Richard's view, but also it's being told in a like an authoritative way, right? Like, so the son is doing this and the daughter's doing this. And it's not always clear that the interpretation of their actions is through Richard's point of view. It's only in like kind of thinking about it that you're like, this is what Richard thinks they're doing and what it means. But it's told almost like authoritatively, like, this is what they're doing and this is what it means. And when you're forced to like write it that way, you're basically in all of their heads, right? You're in all of their heads in terms of like their motivations. And if they aren't speaking, then it probably forces you to write this kind of prose, you know? Very introspective.
Yeah, that's. I remember I was writing a scene where I was in one as a first person narrator's head, and she was encountering basically what in the narrative was her doppelganger, but her doppelganger from like a previous part of her life. And it was like this complicated kind of like they react to each other in a certain way, and they're emotional. Like what's happening inside of each one's head have to like they be this like interesting mirror because it's the doppelgangery, but they can't realize it about one another because it's not like, you
Right.
know, meet your doppelganger and say, hey, you're my doppelganger. But like there's an automatic tension between them because of that. And I had to figure out a way in a first person narrator to
Yeah.
convey the other character's motivations and other character's feelings in the moment while you're looking through the eyes of the first character at that person who doesn't realize those things and
Yes.
consciously. So being able to like step back and say, okay, there is information in this point of view and information in this point of view. I'm trapped in this point of view, but what are the subtle clues that this point of view can notice about that person that will hint at what's going on in that other person's inside their head,
Yeah.
right? That allows the reader to notice that and understand that without the character understanding it. That's like if you step back from it, you don't let just maybe your first draft, you just let it flow. But if you just take every sentence and make sure that you're putting all three of those things into it, you're going to start loading up the sentences with a certain voice, a certain kind of like attention that is going to give the reader what you needs to have. And so it's not a grammatical thing, it's not a stylistic thing, it's kind of like it's a perspective thing. Yeah, it is work though. Like you said, you're not going to copy this one, but you can find one that does work in the moment you're trying to portray if you step back from it and pay careful attention, I think.
Right. And like just now, like hearing you describe that, if you are going to do all of that mental gymnastics to have to accomplish like the point of view and what you're trying to get across, maybe the inevitable result is a style like this where each sentence is so long, has all these like separate little tangents and adjectives and things like that, that maybe it does end up lending itself to a style that is like this, right? Because it's not one of these stories where it's two characters talking and there's less interest in, for your example, caring about what the other character thinks or knows or how they're interpreting it. And stories like that, we always talk about dialogue reading really fast. You know, one character says this and the next person says this and the next person says that. And it's because all we're thinking about, all that's at play is what they're saying to one another, not what our main character is interpreting that they mean, especially in silence, right? So yeah, maybe your writing just ends up having to be that verbose.
It's interesting. We both agree that like our impression of this is that it's filled with long sentences.
Yes.
There's this passage at the end when he's waiting for his son at the end where with the train. It says, a train whistle caused him to lift his head. It was on time. He had hoped it would be late. The slender draw gates descended. The bell of approach tingled happily. The great metal body, horizontally fluted, rocked to a stop, and sleepy teenagers disembarked, his son among them. Those are very, except for that last one, which is a compound with a little description in it, are very short sentences, right? But
Yeah.
they're individual kind of moments in this train of thought that's describing a literal train. But and the train itself is long. It's like extended. It's not just he lifted his head and saw his son disembark from the train that had just arrived. Like you could write it that way. It's watching the whole train pull in and just taking time with the whole thing.
Right.
You can put that in small sentences, but you're still spending time experiencing the entire event. You're not cutting it short or summarizing it in a shorter sentence.
Right.
This is related to my takeaway as well. My takeaway is going to be about voice. It wasn't specific at all, but thinking about how a story should have a voice instead of an author having a voice. It's like my takeaway is just basically I want to think about the voice of a story when I'm writing. Like sometimes I just start writing and it just comes out as like me. And there's a story that I kind of want to write. I had an idea for it recently and I started typing it in and I realized I was just like setting a scene, but I was writing in the style of a story I'd just finished editing.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, this isn't right. This isn't what the story needs. It needs to be something else. And I don't yet know what it is, what it should be. Like, what is that style? What is that feeling of the prose that I want to accomplish? So I couldn't work on it right away. But just that idea of like, sometimes you have an idea for a story and you struggle with writing it because you don't yet know what the prose needs to do, like how it can accomplish the story for you.
Yeah. Maybe none of us gives enough credence to the idea that like an individual story needs to, like you said, have that voice versus just like relying on yourself as being skilled enough to make it come across. Like it's almost like, are you using the right tool?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
I don't know that I've articulated then a takeaway, except that I think I got close to it earlier. I don't know if I said this is my takeaway, but I just like the idea of like a cast of characters all
Oh,
reacting to
yeah.
something and not reacting verbally. I think then, like I said, you'd probably be forced to mimic this style. And if not mimic the style exactly, I just think it makes for a really interesting premise where a group of people is reacting to a divorce or whatever. Just a group of people reacting to like bad news or even good news. It could be good news. This could have been Richard and Joan being like, "We're pregnant," and everyone's like, "Why? Thought you guys hated each other." Yeah, we thought you were getting divorced. Richard's like, "God damn it."
Why are you crying again?
Yeah, Richard would be like, "So you're telling me I could have gotten divorced?"
Just separated. They're not getting divorced.
Yeah, we're just gonna test it out. Okay, guys.
I'm going to test it out by moving in with that woman.
Yeah, I'm gonna test it out down the street with Linda. Linda and I are performing an experiment. We have to conduct it nightly. All right. Thanks, guys.
If you enjoyed this episode, consider joining our Patreon. Your support helps us keep the show running. Find out more at patreon.com/whyisthisgoodpodcast. And for industry news, writing tips, and great short fiction, join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/NaplesWritersWorkshop. You can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter at NaplesWritersWorkshop.com.